Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, the Senate voted down President Obama's plan to repeal $4 billion in tax subsidies for the largest oil and gas companies. The vote was 51 to 47. Two Republicans voted for the plan, while four Democrats voted against it. According to MapLight, the group that follows money in politics, oil and gas companies gave 14 times as much to senators who voted against cutting their subsidies. Today's guest, Abram Lustgarten, writes about the influence big oil has on legislation and regulation in his new book, Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. The book provides a very detailed story of a corporate culture at BP that values profit and controlling costs over the environment and human life. He writes, quote, "Because the series of missteps goes back so far and was so well known by so many people, officials and company executives alike, the events that unfolded on the Deepwater Horizon in April 2010 were also predictable. A career Environmental Protection Agency attorney, the Department of Justice, former employees at BP, all knew something like this might one day happen. Perhaps even the chief executives that led BP through its defining years, Sir John Brown and Tony Hayward, also knew that the strains they put on their company might one day lead to disaster. All of them had failed to prevent it. This is the story of why." Abram Lustgarten is a reporter for ProPublica. He covers energy and the environment. In 2009, he won a George Polk Award for environmental reporting, and he's a former writer with Fortune. Hi, Abram. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I have to say, your book made me and my producer scream because you detail so much information that I obviously have not read before. So before we get into those details, I think it's really important to note that much of this book was written without the cooperation of BP and its executives. You say that throughout 2010, they were informed of your reporting and they were asked to respond to the information you uncovered, but they repeatedly denied your interview requests.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the project began as a joint effort with PBS Frontline, and we not only sought, you know, answers to questions that we had, but sought access to facilities. And we worked on that project for months, and BP strung us along. I mean, they often said that, you know, interview next week, or let me get right back to you about whether you can come on site at Prudhoe Bay up in Alaska, and so forth. And ultimately, they, after months and months of that sort of negotiation, they declined all interviews, and they asked that we submit questions in writing. And their head of PR, their executive in London at the time, personally promised to answer each of those questions. And I followed up with a submission of many, many pages. It was something like a 30-page list of questions, and they sent back a 3-sentence response that says that, basically we do have safe operations around the world.
Just 3 sentences.
Mm-hmm.
So this book is very extensive. You go into detail about what happened not only during the disaster in 2010, but you go back a couple decades. So talk about the reporting that was involved or that is involved in a project like this.
Well, the first thing I did is really turned away from the Gulf of Mexico, where I think that most people were focused, and I was really looking at more systemic problems and trying to understand the culture of the company and the people who lead it, and all roads, all conversations pretty quickly led back to John Brown, a famous executive who became the head of the company in 1995. And he was a visionary in many ways. He was a very strong leader. He was revered in the business community. But he started a process at BP that sought to grow the company almost exponentially in size, very aggressively, very quickly. Basically, the summary of the story is that he overreached, that he grew too fast to control the implications of that growth, and the implications were dire when it came to worker safety and to the environment. And now getting that story is just was a slow and painstaking process. Literally had me you know, in hotel rooms in Anchorage, Alaska, and in, you know, in southern Texas, trying to talk to workers, you know, who had been employed with BP, and very slowly kind of networking through, you know, up from the lowest level employee, you know, up towards more senior managers, building relationships, earning trust, and eventually, you know, getting a lot of documents from these folks.
And your line right now is really good, so if you can stay exactly where you are, we can probably avoid the static we heard earlier, because you have a good line right now. So at this time, let's talk about this. When you go into detail about John Brown, at this time, oil prices were relatively low. Aging sources were peaking in production, and BP was really obsessed with finding new reserves.
Yeah, I mean, the company had the company got its start in Iran, you know, in the 1907 and 1909 for struck oil, and it was disproportionately dependent on oil from Iran and from you know, a lot of the Middle East. And when the revolution took place in Iran, and then it was shortly after, you know, after that followed by, you know, a wave of privatization of oil companies across North Africa and the Middle East, BP really lost out. You know, more all oil companies really suffered, but BP more than the rest, and it found itself you know, with very few assets left to develop, very little oil. The bulk of the reserves that it had available to it were in the North Sea, just north of England, and in the United States, potentially in the Gulf of Mexico, and very much so up in Alaska. So with those limited opportunities, John Brown both sought to cut costs and develop that oil as much as he possibly could, but also was looking for a shortcut. And he found the shortcut by acquiring companies in the space of growing the company, as one person said, you know, on Wall Street as opposed to out in the oil fields. In the space of 2 years, between 1999 and 2001, he acquired seven companies, including ARCO and Amoco, two huge American oil companies with ties back to the old Standard Oil, with you know, upwards of 80,000 employees between them. And he quickly leapfrogged BP to becoming, you know, one of the largest oil conglomerates in the world.
And what was the corporate culture like back then in terms of, I mean, your overall book, it's pretty clear based on the evidence that you uncover, they really valued profit and controlling costs over the environment and human life. But what was it like back then?
Well, you know, BP originally, British Petroleum, was a company with a very strong engineering focus. I don't think that anybody then or now, you know, at the company would say that they don't care about worker safety or that they don't care about the environment. And especially back then, the company had a very solid fundamental standing. There is a difference between how you know, BP, a British company, and an American oil company tend to run things. The British place a lot of trust in their management. They trust the cohesiveness of their organization, and they allow some creative freedom. American corporate leadership in the oil industry in particular is much more regimented, places far less responsibility in lower level management, and relies on a strict kind of chain of command and strict, you know, dictates of authority from the top executives. So where one of the places where BP ran into trouble was as it acquired those American companies, it had a looser corporate, you know, ethos that placed some degree of responsibility and allowed creativity with lower management. But the American management that was acquired was looking for stronger guidance from the top that they didn't necessarily see. So you kind of have a, you know, it gets kind of technical, but you basically had a communication gap, and that festered. You know, we have a 100,000 person organization with operations all across the continent, handling you know, $1 billion projects in very different, difficult and dangerous situations. You know, that kind of communication gap festered. And so what you had was a budget mandate coming from London, from the top of BP, that says, here we have this goal. You know, we want to cut 25% of the budget, and it's very aggressive, and we want you all to do it, and we trust that you know how to do that responsibly, meaning, you know, we don't want you to go spill oil to do it. Just figure it out. And you have staff and management in these acquired corporations in the United States who say, you know, who think, we need to please. You don't want to cross those executives in London. We can't quite figure out this puzzle. The only way we're going to be able to do it is, you know, is to to cut corners. But we feel that it's so important to please, you know, our new bosses in London, and we're afraid to tell them that we can't do that, that we're just going to figure it out on our own as they wish. And the judgment, you know, at the lower end of the corporation didn't quite match the judgment that was expected from the top.
Let's talk a little bit about how BP dealt with past explosions, because you talk about messaging, and you quote Joseph Pratt, a professor of history at the University of Houston, who says, quote, without a doubt, in 40 years inside the oil industry, BP was the smoothest talking oil company I've ever seen. So let's go back and look at what happened in 2005, the massive explosion at its Texas refinery. And I believe the anniversary was just last week.
It was, yeah, March 23rd.
And five people were killed, 170 people were injured. The Houston Chronicle recently had a piece, and they quote Catherine Rodriguez, whose father was killed in 2005, and she says, quote, if this information does not get released because of the settlement, then what happens on the next rig? More lives are lost, more families are grieving. Four more people have been killed since then in the same refinery. So talk a little bit about how BP is able to deal with these explosions and continue drilling. I mean, a lot of people actually, when this last settlement was announced, said they were shocked that BP actually got away with what happened in the Gulf.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, 15 people actually died in the Texas City refinery explosion. It's one of the worst, I think it may be the worst industrial disaster in the United States in modern history. And the way that BP responded after that accident looked just right, and that's part of what's so alarming when you look at what's happening with the Gulf today. BP was apologetic, was forthcoming in its apologies. It hired outside consultants who did numerous reports who concluded that the company, you know, had a lax approach to safety and had various failures in management, which, you know, was critical and brought out some sort of details. But BP's response to that was to pledge a renewed focus of safety. It, because of Texas City and because of problems in Alaska also, it hired an independent ombudsman's office. It hired the former chief counsel for the Central Intelligence Agency to create an independent body that workers could feel safe going to and complaining about their safety concerns. It pledged in front of Congress and to the public and in advertising campaigns that it had a renewed approach to safety and the environment, and it rebranded the company a couple of years before, but it pushed a rebranding of the company along those lines as well. So it really, its PR machine was huge and spun fast and communicated everything that the American public wanted to hear to be reassuring. But then, and in other instances, other examples besides that, the companies had a really difficult time following through, really, you know, putting the rubber to the road, so to speak. And so that's the pattern that I think emerges when you start to look at what happened in the Gulf of Mexico is you saw some of the same poor decision-making and mistakes that led up to and caused the disaster, and then you see almost an exact replica of the response and statements afterwards, you know, from the pledges to renew their focus on safety and to be more responsible and to be better next time, to the way that they've handled their cases in court and tried to settle as much as possible and tried to minimize their costs.
So you've got this slick multi-million dollar PR machine. What role are the media playing here? Because the reporters are the ones that are supposed to expose this and do what you did in terms of digging to find a clear pattern here, to find out that they cut corners. So what is your assessment of media coverage of a company like BP? And let's talk specifically about the 2005 explosion in Texas.
Sure. You know, I actually think that with that case, which was very high profile, and with the Gulf spill as well, you know, I think that there's been a lot of really great reporting about those disasters. In the Gulf, we saw some of the best hard-hitting, very technical analysis of the problems and what went wrong. So there's a lot to be commended there. But I think that and this is, I think, the case in a lot of big stories, this one included. I think that there's often a failure to take a step back and look at the bigger picture and connect the dots. And you know, with BP, the dots were, you know, bold and begging to be connected, and that was kind of there for the taking. In general, you know, I think it's really important for, you know, for the media to step back and think about larger meaning and think about what's happening and think about patterns. And, you know, accountability can't always just be focused on one accident one day. You know, a prior record is relevant.
And what about a politician's role in all of this? You write about politicians that gave BP advice throughout all of this. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, the biggest, you know, BP as one of the largest corporations operating in the United States and one of the largest oil companies in the world, it exerts a huge political influence. I didn't look specifically at their campaign finance or anything like that, you know, but you could generally expect that it's large. What I found in the government's treatment of BP is indications anyway that the government considers BP too big to fail, essentially, and that is to say that well, one of the characters in my book is an Environmental Protection Agency attorney whose job is to work with the company over many years and make it compliant and make it a better steward of the environment, and if they can't do that, then the government is supposed to enact you know, what this quote unquote nuclear option, which is to ban BP from business in the United States.
And you're talking about Jean Pascal?
I am talking about Jean Pascal.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and so over the years, everything that's happened has clearly met the legal standard for what they call debarment or banning the company from operations in the U.S., but the government has not chosen to do that, and I think that's a symptom of the size and strength of BP and its importance to the U.S. economy and the threat that's perceived in you know, in the political environment.
The Huffington Post ran a piece late last year called BP's Lobbying Clout, 27 former Hill White House staffers working for oil giants. They also have some information here about the Podesta Group, which is John Podesta's group.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking today with Abram Lustgarten. He's out with a new book called Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. And Abram is a reporter with ProPublica, and we decided to have him on the show solo today on our weekly media roundtable because there's so much explosive information in his book that hasn't been widely reported, and so we wanted to talk about that and also the role that the media really play in covering these giant oil companies. Just yesterday, the Senate voted down President Obama's plan to get rid of $4 billion in tax subsidies. And so what are your thoughts on how the media covers big oil and gas, how they cover the BP oil disaster, and where we go from here? Right now, Shell is waiting to get the okay to start drilling in the Arctic this summer. And we'll also talk with Abram about that. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your overall thoughts on the media's coverage of the environment and what we're facing right now in terms of oil exploration and then alternatives? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So why don't we talk a little bit about this recent $8 billion settlement with BP, and this is obviously with the BP, the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster. And I wanted to ask you specifically about Eva Rowe, because you write about Eva Rowe, who her parents were killed in the explosion, and she didn't settle in the beginning, and she decided to take BP to court. And I have to say that when I read about her story in your book, I mean, it reads like a scary spy novel. Because she told you that she was followed. At some point, she was afraid of sitting by her window because she was afraid that BP executives were following her. Can you tell us what you found out about Eva Rowe?
Yeah, I mean, Eva Rowe has become a bit of a folk hero and actually a hero in many senses. I mean, her court case you know, resulted in the release of millions of pages of documents, many of which were essential to the kind of reporting that I did. You know, as you said, she lost both her parents in the explosion of the Texas City refinery in 2005. She was, at the time, a young girl, and BP faced 4,000 lawsuits related to that case, and almost every single one of them was settled quickly. Eva Rowe was not initially comfortable with a settlement. She felt like it was a payoff to buy her parents, and so she challenged the company and her lawyers, who are high-profile plaintiff's attorneys in Texas, brought this, they sought to take it to trial. And the more serious the case got, the more funny things got. And essentially, Eva told me stories about being pressured or being intimidated by hot private investigators that were hired by BP. They looked into her past. They dug up all sorts of problems that she had had. She had had past problems with drinking and with drug addiction, which really bore no relevance whatsoever to whether the refinery that her parents went to work in every day was safe or not. But BP made that an issue. They made it a character issue. Brown bags full of dossiers about Eva Rowe began to appear on Houston reporters' desks. She would notice cars parked outside her house, just kind of watching her coming and going. One day, she recounts the story to me. She was pulled over and arrested. Little explanation as to why. Just a very rough and very intimidating experience, and she was brought down to the local jail. And only then, when her lawyers showed up, did the local law enforcement officials decide that they didn't have or they weren't clear on what the exact cause was for her to have been called in the first place, and they let her go. She interpreted that as one more kind of form of intimidation against her to keep her from pursuing this lawsuit. And this is something that BP had done before. Back in the 1990s, it had hired a private investigation firm to follow and trick and get another individual who was pressuring the company up in Alaska to quit their case and to leave the company alone. They used a group of former CIA operatives who run a company called the Wackenhut Group, which is one of the largest private investigation and private security firms in the world. So this was, a precedent that BP had set already in the past.
And I hadn't heard about this before, and we've followed this case pretty closely. Are these well-known facts? Did this get widely reported?
The
Eva Rowe story, and just the fact that she was followed and that photos were taken of her when she was at bars or leaving restaurants with her friends.
I'm not sure whether those aspects of her story were widely told. I mean, she's been interviewed in dozens of stories and at the time was on 60 Minutes. And, the media has paid attention to her. I don't know the degree to which they paid attention to that kind of darker side, of the case. Often what happens, and you were asking a little bit about, how the media works in this way. But often what happens in cases like that is there's so much information and so much of it is really important. And so when you have news organizations that are reporting on the merits of the case, sometimes, the drama, what's happening, behind the scenes to the people who are bringing it gets lost or doesn't seem as relevant at the time.
And so Eva Rowe eventually settled?
Eva Rowe did settle under terms that she's never disclosed exactly how much money she personally received. But one of the things that she was seeking from the beginning was the public disclosure of documents. And one of the reasons that BP sought settlement was to contain those documents so that the public would never see them. So one of the conditions of Eva Rowe's settlement, which was really a huge victory for her and her attorneys and for all of us, was BP's agreement to put some 700 million pages of documents into the public record, where they can forever be found and read by anybody who's willing to bore themselves to death reading it, which is partly what I did. She also won tens of millions of dollars that were distributed to some of the hospitals that responded to patients injured in the explosion, to medical universities there in the Galveston and Southern Texas area. So a lot of that money eventually did a lot of good.
We're speaking with Abram Lustgarten, reporter with ProPublica, about his new book, Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. It's our weekly media roundtable. We're talking about media coverage of the big oil companies' disasters and where we're going from here. You can join us, 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Next time on Work with Marty Nemko, Linda Seabright. One person, 10 professional careers, no degree. She's a KALW listener who's going to come in to tell us lessons from her career travails. Plus, you can call in for a 3-minute workover on Work with Marty Nemko, Sunday at 11. That's Sundays from 11 to noon here on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. And speaking of the environment and energy, on Monday, we're going to have a debate about what should be done with California's last two nuclear power plants. There's going to be, well, if they get enough signatures by April 16th, the California Nuclear Initiative will be on the November ballot, which would shut down the last two power plants in the state of California. So we'll be having a debate about that. Today, it's our weekly media roundtable, and we're speaking with ProPublica reporter Abram Lustgarten about his new book, Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. And right before the break, we were talking about this young woman, Eva Rowe, whose two parents were killed during the Deepwater Horizon disaster, and she refused in the beginning to settle. And in the book, Abram has a photo of her, and next to the photo it says Eva Rowe was in a convenience store when she learned from news reports that the Texas City refinery had exploded. Both of her parents were killed in the blast. The company sent her one letter and a check for $25,000. I want to extend our sincere condolences on the death of your loved one, James, the letter stated. It made no mention of her mother, Linda. And that's in the new book, Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. And we've got full lines. We'll have a free one in just a couple minutes. You can join us at 866-798-8255. And I'm sorry, her parents actually died in the Texas disaster, not in the Gulf of Mexico. And that happened in 2005. The anniversary was just last week. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Dave in Sacramento. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to float a number that came out yesterday and included in the conversation here, tying it back to Silicon Valley. Last year, oil companies invested, and I say invested, $30 million in lobbying. For that, they got $4 billion in subsidies yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
That is a better venture investment than almost any that has ever been made in Silicon Valley. And tying it back to the media conversation, I think one of the things that media representatives can do is to constantly hammer that theme, to point out the amazing fact of our democracy that it's so cheap to buy.
Well, thank you for that. And, Abram, I wanted to ask you a question about this, because Exxon made $5 million in profits per hour and last year. And the group MapLight, which points out that oil companies gave 14 times as much to senators who voted against these oil subsidies, points out things like, for example, Ben Nelson, Jim Webb voted no. And some of these senators, we're talking $472. Jim Inhofe, he's the one that gets the largest amount from the oil companies, followed by Mary Landrieu, $424,000, which is really not much when you're looking at the fact that Exxon makes $5 million in profit per hour.
I mean, no, it's not much to Exxon.
Right.
You know, these are elected officials who need to fund their campaigns, and they, you know, they are eager for those contributions from whoever they come from. And I think you see this across all industries. You'd certainly see it in the pharmaceutical or the chemical industries, as well as the oil industry. And there's a, you know, part of it seems sordid, and part of it is just human nature. But there's certainly a gratitude that's expressed, you know, and those donors remain, you know, at the front, you know, of thinking of these politicians as they make their key decisions, and they're thinking about who they're representing and who the policy decisions are going to benefit and who they're going to hurt. So, you know, you could see it as a sort of criminal buyout, or you could see it as a sort of subtler influence that's just very hard to avoid as long as these sorts of contributions are allowed.
And again, yesterday's vote was 51-47. Two Republicans, the two senators from Maine, voted to end the subsidies, and 4 Democrats voted to continue the subsidies. And you can find specific information about this bill and the money at yourcallradio.org. And thank you again for calling, Dave. Let's go next to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for an informative program and for taking my call. I'd like you guests to give us an update on what's happening off the coast of Scotland, where a platform operated by Total, the French company, is having serious problems, a huge gas leak, and of course the gas is full of hydrogen sulfide, and they don't quite know how to put that out. I wonder if you would comment on that. And again, we're getting reports that the company was negligent. They've known for quite a few weeks that there was a problem with the leak, potential problem, and nothing was done. I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you for a good...
Okay, thank you, Max. Have you been following this, Abram?
You know, just a little bit. I don't know the details about the history and alleged negligence, you know, but what's unfolding there in the North Sea is quite serious. You know, I'm hearing that they're looking at a long-term solution that, you know, like what happened in the Gulf of Mexico, or even worse, it could take many, many months to drill a relief well and cut off the leak that's happening there. In the meantime, there's a desperate effort to prevent an explosion. You know, workers, not only on the rigs in question, but in all the surrounding rigs, have been evacuated. So, you know, so the immediate threat to a number of people from an explosion is fairly well mitigated. But right now there's an astronomical amount of gas that's spewing into the air, and that's pollution, and it's a potent greenhouse gas as well.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Max. We'll put a link to a couple articles after the show, yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thanks. I guess the one word that comes to mind, and I think your guest used the word earlier in your discussion, and that's accountability. It just seems like the more I listen to your program, over and over again, whether it's a corporation like BP or a local police department or some other company such as the companies that are going to be working on this Exxon pipeline in the Midwest. The fact of the matter is, it seems like we're living in an absolutely dysfunctional and corrupt sort of political and economic system where there is absolutely no accountability for people at individual levels or at corporate levels, and they just can continue to get away with these absolute catastrophes, and it just seems like there's just absolutely no way to stop this. And I just want to give you one example, which is a little bit off the subject, but I'll tell you where I'm trying to get at. When John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States, was testifying in front of Congress, he was under oath, and he claimed that he would not be an activist judge. He did not believe in that. And then we have him voting in Citizens United. So here's the Chief Justice of the United States being one of the most activist judges you can possibly imagine, and this guy he's unaccountable to anybody at this point. He's going to serve a lifetime, and that's what we're stuck with. I think that pervades the entire society, and I think that lack of accountability is really a huge problem.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. What are your thoughts on that, Abram? Accountability. We wanted to ask you about accountability, for example, in Prudhoe Bay, Alaska.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak to this in the context of BP and my reporting there, but I generally have to agree, and I would say that it's the very definition of a corporation in terms of business law and tax law is in a way to blur accountability. It's not necessarily meant in this context, but it's in a financial context. In BP in particular, we've seen criminal investigations. We've seen the law exercised, I think, as best as it can be, with a few exceptions. We have 3 criminal convictions, hundreds of violations. Every enforcement agency, from the EPA to the Department of Justice to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, involved in devoting resources and time. Numerous civil suits and consistently the largest fines and settlements in corporate history, culminating with the settlements coming out of the Gulf. So we're talking about billions of dollars, and still, it is not a deterrent to continue to operate this way, and it's not really an impact. I mean, BP has some of the great largest profits this year and last quarter that it's had in recent years and ever. And throughout that period, there has never been, in all of these crimes and each of these spills and explosions and disasters, there has never been yet a single individual in the BP Corporation held accountable, whether that's a low-level employee or a top-level executive. You know, so I do think that that there's a clear lack of accountability, that the measures that are imposed so far aren't effective in terms of exacting accountability. And you have to ask at some point when you look at a company like BP that has this sort of record over two decades, whether the mechanisms that that our government and our society has in place to hold corporations accountable works.
We're speaking with Abram Lustgarten. He's a reporter with ProPublica. He covers energy and the environment, and he's out with a new book, Run to Failure, BP, and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. And I wanted to mention one more time that Abram asked BP several times to respond to the information he uncovered. They declined giving him a three-line statement. And again, what did the statement say, Abram?
Well, I haven't read it in a little while, but it said that the BP does not have a track record of safety problems, that each of its incidents have been isolated and are unique, and that it's that safety and environmental protection is a high priority for the company.
And you can join us. We've got just over 10 minutes left. If you have any questions or comments about how the media covers this issue, how should they cover this issue? Again, just yesterday, the Senate voted down a plan to end $4 billion in tax subsidies to the oil companies. What are your thoughts on how the media covers big oil and gas and where we're going from here? Alternative sources. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Greg writes in, Greg from Berkeley, can you comment on Greg Palast's long investigations in both of his books, Armed Madhouse and Vulture's Picnic, into BP, linking their negligence to the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska 20 years ago, as well as the Caspian Sea blowout more recently? Greg writes, this seems more like a pattern rather than isolated incidents.
I haven't read Greg Palast's books. I'm familiar with some of his reporting, but those incidents are exactly the focus of the pattern that I looked at, and they absolutely are part of a pattern and not not isolated incidents. You did see the same some of the same problems in the Caspian Sea. My book starts with the Exxon Valdez spill and the Alyeska pipeline, which is the pipeline that runs oil from the North Slope of Alaska down to the port of Valdez, where it can be loaded onto ships like the Exxon Valdez. The Alyeska pipeline is run by a consortium of those oil companies, and the majority shareholder and manager is BP, and has been and was at the time of the disaster. The way the operating agreement runs is it says that Alyeska is responsible for initial environmental response if there's a spill in the port of Valdez area. And when the Exxon Valdez spill happened, Alyeska failed to respond, and that is the first link in the story that I tell, demonstrating the corporate attitude towards environmental response and cleanup. John Brown was not yet CEO of the company, but he was there in Alaska when the Exxon Valdez spill happened, and he remarks with surprise, why isn't anybody doing anything? His employee, who's also the manager of the Alyeska pipeline, comes to him and says there's a spill and doesn't appear to be quick enough response. And John Brown writes in his memoir, which I quote, he writes, "Well, do something." And that was one of the first steps, the first signs that that BP wasn't placing enough emphasis on an environmental protection and environmental response.
And Greg also says, thank you for covering a topic neglected by the media, which is paid by oil. What sort of effect do you think oil advertising has on, and oil underwriting has on, media coverage?
Well, you know, I'd like to think that it doesn't have an effect. Of course, you know, it's a huge source of advertising revenue, as are you know, other industries. I'd like to think that you know, certainly all the news organizations that I've worked with, there has been a rigorous enough separation of church and state that has not ever been a factor in my reporting or any you know, of the reporting of my colleagues at their various news organizations.
All right, well, thank you for the email, Greg. And let's hear next from Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Last night I attended a public forum unmasking the Bay Area Biolab and synthetic biology, and one of the presenters there mentioned that the Gulf oil spill was actually declared officially over in a paper published by University of California, Berkeley scientists who are very compromised by BP. And in it, they said, you know, microbes had miraculously eaten the oil, and then the microbes disappeared. And this story was actually corroborated by the New York Times, and this was kind of how the whole thing just, people stopped talking about it. Evidently, that was what we were informed about. So I thought that was a pretty interesting to know that in our backyard we have compromised professors who are involved in and scientists who've become corrupted by becoming entrepreneurs in these business ventures.
Abram, what are your thoughts on this? We did a few shows about conflicts of interest during the time of the explosion.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly raises concerns about conflict of interest. BP has a very large fund. I think I'm digging back into my memory, but we're talking about a $500 million fund for scientific research that is given to support labs at UC Berkeley. I would be careful about drawing conclusions or describing those scientists as corrupted. You know, it's very difficult to get into somebody's head and to understand their motivations. But for sure, you know, it raises questions of conflict of interest. You know, it also raises questions of semantics. I mean, how does one define a spill over? You know, their research could be very accurate in the context of their definition and not accurate in terms of or not even attempting to address, you know, a larger range of impacts or environmental impact over time. But taking a step back from that specific issue and looking more broadly, you do see corporations, you do see the oil industry and BP in particular engaging in a very heavy-handed way in academic research. I mean, BP is a founder and one of the largest funders in Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Energy Institute, for example, which is one of the most influential scientific organizations when it comes to energy research.
You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you, you provide incredible visuals in your book just in terms of what it takes to put a rig in the depths of the ocean. And it never entered my mind when you think about what it takes. And your opening paragraph says, the burst of gas came from so deep within the bowels of the earth, it may as well have come from another world, 13,000 feet beneath the ocean's silty floor and the earth's crust, and another 5,000 feet underwater. A total depth farther than 14 Empire State Buildings stacked atop one another, hydrocarbons in the form of hot fluid saturated with dissolved methane seeped through the reinforced walls of a new oil well. And that just speaks volumes about what is happening to the environment to get this oil.
Yeah, I mean it's a forceful technique. I mean we pound a straw basically deep down into the earth, and we have all of these mechanisms and pipes and layers of steel and cement and so forth. But the bottom line is, we are trying to stick a conduit into a very, very powerful reservoir, you know, of resources that's under pressure and is extremely high temperatures. And you know, it's both technologically astounding that we can do that, and it's quite admirable, and it's also you know, worth remembering that that we're messing with something much larger than, you know, than technology or the mechanics that we build there, you know, have the ability to deal with.
You write, on the ocean floor, the kick, as such a geologic burp is called in the oil industry, shot through the top of the well at the seafloor and continued upward through the mile-deep water and the long hose of steel called a riser pipe that connected the well to the surface. There, it slammed into the deep water Deepwater Horizon drill, a 30-story structure with a footprint the size of an average Walmart supercenter floating in the Gulf of Mexico. And is this what they want to put in the Arctic? That's the other visual I'm trying to come up with.
These are very similar to the kind of rigs that would be used in the Arctic and are. There's different techniques depending on which exact location. I visited some of BP's facilities in the Arctic, and they are drilling now from a land-based rig, a giant new rig called Liberty. So it's a little bit different, but it is still, a several hundred foot tall structure that the water is very shallow, so they dug out, a bunch of earth fill and built a mound and put it on solid land instead of floating. But yes, these are the type of machines. I mean, it's essentially a floating factory. And they'll put them in the Arctic, and they're along the coast of Brazil and along the coast of Africa and throughout the Gulf of Mexico. And, this is the future of drilling.
And to drill in the Arctic, are they basically just waiting for the government okay, or what's the process at this point?
Well, yeah, they're waiting for permission for expanded leasing across regions that they want to drill, first of all. And secondly, and this, you saw happen with Shell last week, approval of the drilling plan and their emergency response plan, which is what was so controversial in the Gulf of Mexico, because BP's spill response plan was, later found to be horribly inadequate. So it's a slow progression to drill in the Arctic. The risks, First of all, it's new, but the risks are as great as the Gulf in terms of the drilling itself, and then far greater in terms of the capability, to respond to a disaster because of the remote terrain and because of the ice coverage in the winter months, and because of the the sea life and ecological life that's up there. Mm-hmm. So the stakes are just much, much greater.
Well, we have time for a few more callers. Let's hear from William in San Francisco. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. Excuse me. I'd like some reassurance that the guest was kidding, being sarcastic, when he said that after one disaster, BP set up a whole set of mechanisms to improve the situation, to create transparency, to allow employees to report things, etc. And then he made this statement. I'm intrigued by words. He said, but they had difficulty. That's the word he used. They had difficulty in putting these goals into practice. Now, I couldn't tell whether I was listening to the Colbert Report or to someone who was saying that seriously. It's as if someone robs a bank and then is convicted, etc., and then robs another bank, and in reporting on it, someone said he had difficulty in not robbing the second bank, as if there's not some sort of volitional situation involved. And I'd please guess.
All right, Abram, what did you mean by that?
Oh, well, I meant exactly what I said. Unfortunately, I wasn't being sarcastic. I appreciate the caller's comments. I say difficulty in large part to give BP a fair shake, but the bottom line is we are not talking about one individual at the top of the corporation who has his finger on every single control. We're talking about an organizational structure with 100,000 employees spread across 30 odd countries, and so it is a challenge from a business sense, from an organizational development sense, to steer a big change, a cultural change, and that's why the book really explores it doesn't aim to demonize individuals, but explores the challenge and the depth of this as a cultural problem within this corporation. So I'm allowing for good intentions and that this is a very challenging thing that the company still importantly failed to execute. And that's what I mean by saying difficult.
You do write extensively about the drive to make money and cut any corner possible.
It's very difficult because the papers, the documents that I got from BP, were crude in their demands for budget cuts. And in some cases, like, you know, like what happened in Texas City and one or two specific examples in Alaska, they appear to be criminal. Some of my sources described the conduct as criminal. In Texas City, BP, its management warned its executives that they were going to lose lives, that workers were going to die if they didn't fix a piece of equipment, and they chose not to fix it to save $100,000. So there's a clear accountability in cases like that.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we're talking with Abram Lustgarten, Run to Failure. And you also write about, for example, in the photo under the rig in Houston, you say before the blast in 2005 killed 15 workers, an internal report had said that workers at the Texas plant had, quote, an exceptional degree of fear. One worker had died at the plant about every 18 months for the previous 30 years. In 2002, BP decided not to upgrade key safety equipment in order to save $150,000.
Yeah, the documents that came out of the Texas City case were extraordinary. What you saw for years before that explosion killed 15 workers was the consistent and repeated ringing of alarm bells. You not only saw the budget cut pressures exacting, you know, lack of maintenance and failure to change, you know, the conditions at BP Texas City refinery, but that coupled with risk analysis that put a dollar amount on the head of employees that essentially said that, you know, in a worst case scenario, our employees are worth, you know, about $10 million, and when you hold that up to what it costs to operate the plant, how much money can be made by not making certain changes, the implication was that it was more profitable to continue operating as they were.
And we didn't have time to go into Prudhoe Bay, but you write that Prudhoe Bay was operating with corroded pipes. It had oil leaking out. When it leaked for inspectors, the lines hadn't been plugged since 91. So, you know, obviously the question is, where were the inspectors here? And what does it look like today?
Well,
just quickly.
Well, today I hear that conditions are bad but possibly improving. Again, this is a slow-moving story, so it's hard to tell, but I was just hearing some good news from workers up on the slope. And inspections, I mean, there's certainly accountability still to be explored there among regulators and why they didn't find pipeline problems sooner.
So here we are. Cheap oil is running out, and it's going to take these companies to go to pristine places like the Arctic or to drill in the depths of the ocean to get this oil. What role does the media play from here on out?
Well, you know, I would highlight both the media and the public's role. You know, I think it's important for the media to keep a spotlight on not just where the energy development is happening and the jobs that are created and the balance of imports versus, you know, exports or domestically produced oil, but to look at the consequences. And, you know, bigger picture and more importantly, I think it's important for the public to connect their lifestyles with their expectations for environmental preservation. I mean, I think that a lot of what BP did is bad, but the bottom line is that they're out there drilling, and so is the rest of the industry, because they're providing us with the oil that we use to drive everywhere
and to do
the rest of the things that we do.
Such an important point. Thank you so much. Abram Lustgarten, author of Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. He's also a reporter with ProPublica. Thank you, Abram.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening. Sorry about that static. I think that's on our end, and we'll get that taken care of as soon as we can. It's Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What should be done with California's last two nuclear power plants? On the next Your Call, we'll have a debate about the California Nuclear Initiative, which would shut down the Diablo Canyon and San Onofre nuclear plants. Nuclear power makes up 15% of California's total energy production, so what are the alternative sources? The campaign has until April 16th to collect enough signatures needed to put the initiative on the ballot. So where do you stand on the issue? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Latif the Truth Speaker is a rapper from Oakland, and the song that changed his life might not be the kind of song you'd expect.
Cloudburst by Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross.
Hey, baby!
A lot of people say, oh, hip-hop started in the 80s or hip-hop started in the 70s. And that song was recorded in 1959.
It's the good stuff in culture on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI.
Bullseye, Sunday afternoon at 4 here on local public radio KALW San Francisco. Stay tuned next from the BBC. It's World Have Your Say here on KALW San Francisco.
Hi, I'm Jill McGivering. Welcome to World Have Your Say, where France and Islamism are on your agenda.
Ce qui s'est passé ce matin va continuer. Il y aura d'ailleurs...
What happened this morning is going to continue. There will be other operations that will continue and will allow us to expel from our country a certain number of people who basically have no reason to be here.
19 suspected Islamists have been detained in raids across France. Most are held in Toulouse, where an extremist, Mohamed Merah, murdered 7 people in a series of gun attacks which shocked not just France, but the world. So is their approach right? The best way to deal with what some people call the enemy within? Or should you be left alone to have whatever views you want, as long as you don't harm anyone? On Twitter, use the hashtag WHYS.